Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast, and on this week's episodes, I'm flying solo, answering your questions on Brighton, Nottingham Forest, Arsenal, and maybe some players who could change positions, plus players the stats hate that I love. While over on the subscription side, I'm taking more questions in anything but football, on how I ended up at Football Daily, on films, on books, skincare, clothing, and anything else. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So, straight into the show, and yeah, I'm flying solo this week. Believe it or not, something big is happening in Pete Dorman's life, so he is absent. So I've got to ask your forgiveness at the beginning for any technical issues that we might encounter in the course of this episode. I'm doing my best. I'm not an editor. Frankly, it's beneath me. I farm it out to the little people, like Pete. I never learned to do it because I didn't want to. So hopefully we will make up for what we lose in technical quality here today in some research, because I'm going to try and answer a few of your questions on a few different clubs, do a nice little roundup as we approach the run-in, because we're 25 games into the Premier League season now. We're in the knockout stages of the Champions League. Everything is starting to roll downhill towards crunch time. So it's an interesting point to take stock of some of these teams, especially some of the ones that have changed quite a bit this season. So I'm going to start off with Eastern Opinions question. He says, what next for Brighton? He, she, they. Says, what next for Brighton? Invested a lot in the summer and their young players should improve. But do they double down and spend more, or maybe cash in on João Pedro or Mitoma? So obviously this question comes in the light of Karu Mitoma having a big offer from Saudi Arabia in January. Apparently there was an offer at 65 mil. Brighton said no. Apparently there was a second offer at 90 mil. Reportedly Brighton said no. Now, nobody really thinks that's what happened, because Brighton are not going to say no to 90 mil for a 27-year-old. It's more likely to me that Mitoma said, I don't want to go to Saudi Arabia. And Brighton said, okay, we'll say that we rejected it. Or maybe they have some ambition I don't know about for the rest of the season, but I can't imagine what that would be. So I think that probably there's a little bit of bullshit behind that. Anyway, Brighton obviously had an enormous summer. And they bought a bunch of primarily young players who we really like. Now, there are a couple in there who are a little bit older. So Mats Wiefer, for example, is 24. He was expected to be an immediate contributor. Minte, on the other hand, very, very young. Gruda, very, very young. They've gone out and they've signed Tsimas, I believe that's his name, in January. So he'll join in the summer. He's 19. So there are a bunch of these very, very young players that they've brought in. So I think they expected not necessarily to make Champions League this year, but to continue building towards the future, maybe to peak in a year or two's time. Now, in a way, it's a little bit difficult for them, because some of their players feel like they're already at the point where they would be looking for a move, like João Pedro, like Baleba, and others still feel kind of raw and like works in progress, like Minte. So you're not at the stage of the project where you're going to sell a bunch of these guys and completely retool. But also, there might be guys who start agitating for big moves. So they're going to have to do some work to keep everyone happy if they want to keep this group together. I think that is what they want to do. And I think they probably need some defensive reinforcements if they want to go for the Champions League, or maybe even something more next year. You know, Dunk, Feltman, these guys are both 33 and among their five most used outfielders. And Dunk in particular looks to be slowing down, which is not that surprising. They probably need to be getting more out of Wiefer as well. That's I'd say, part of the defensive issue this season. They've had some inconsistency in midfield. So we all love Baleba. Baleba's played 71% of available minutes. We all like Ayari. Maybe we like Hinshelwood. But they're 21 and 19 respectively. It just doesn't feel super solid through the center of the pitch. Now, if they need money, going and selling Mitoma would make a lot of sense. He's 28 in May. But I don't think you need to do it aggressively. If you have cash on hand, and they probably do, given their sales over the last few years, I don't think that you really need to go and make a concerted effort to sell Mitoma. Because if you look at his career minutes, he's got under 200 club matches, which is two-thirds, half of what we might see from someone of his age normally. I've talked about this previously with Rashford. So he might be one of those guys who has kind of a late peak On the other hand, he's had some injuries, so that could cut the other way. But I wouldn't be surprised if Mitoma kept his pace, kept his burst a little bit longer than other players of his age. I would still sell him if the money's really, really good, because the depth is crazy. The depth really is crazy. And they're going to have to think. It looks like Tsimas is going to be their Welbeck replacement, right? Welbeck is 34. Brighton still look their best when he's on the field. They need to think whether it's going to be Rutter, whether it's going to be Tsimas, whether Ferguson's going to come back. But if you hear me saying, oh, maybe this, but maybe that, that's kind of because that is where we are. We don't know if somebody's going to come in with a crazy bid for Baleba. We don't know who's agitating for a move behind the scenes. I think that if big money comes in for Mitoma, you probably want to do it and use that to get a new centre back or something. But on the other hand, you don't want to change over too many starters in one summer. There'll probably be a new starter in defence next year. Welbeck could easily just completely lose it at some point, you know, lose his step, lose everything. That's not uncommon at his age. You don't want to have too much squad turnover there. So these are all things that Brighton have to balance. Unfortunately, Brighton are super smart and probably already thinking about these things, or have been for a while. The bigger question to me is Hützle. I like him. Brighton obviously like him. They took a big swing on him. But he's definitely cost them some points this season. He's been trying some new things tactically. He's been getting up to speed in the Premier League. The depth of managerial talent in the Prem is such now that you go from having to coach against an extremely high-pressing, very attacking side like Spurs into a deep block and counter side like Nottingham Forest, into a very physical side like Arsenal. Like there are all sorts of different challenges that you have to face, and Hützle is very, very young and he needs practice to get good at that. And there's been some really bad stuff in there. You know, you think about some of the goals that have been given away cheaply in build-up play, the Forest loss, which was brutal. Brighton can hold this squad together for a bit. If Brighton have got all these guys on decent contracts and they can refuse to sell, they can. And okay, maybe you turn down 120 mil for Baleba and then he gets injured and you never get that offer again, but you're still going to get some offer, or he's going to stay at your club and be useful. And you kind of have to gamble at a certain point if you want to do something special. So I'd be tempted to hold the squad together. I think that is what they want to do. But that window, the window where you can force these guys to stick around, is 2 to 3 years. You know, you can't give them 9-year contracts and keep them together for 4 or 5 years. So you've got 2 to 3 years to do something. And if Hützle is still adapting for one of those years or half of that time, you narrow your chance to do something special. And that's assuming he does adapt. He might never. He might just not be great. Or he might be great in 5 years' time. Or 10 years' time. Or in 15 years' time. In 15 years' time, he's still only in his mid-40s. And Brighton just don't know how he's going to develop. So, yeah, I'd target at least one centre-back in the summer. I would be thinking hard about what the plan is at centre forward. They've got loads of options, Ferguson, Rutter, Tsimas, even Pedro, but which one is likely to be the centre forward long term? Because that's going to affect the profiles you want in different positions. But I'd be thinking very, very, very hard about manager. Is there somebody who we can get in while Man City are rebuilding and also probably gearing up for Pep to leave, while Liverpool are unlikely to have Mo Salah have the same season again? Even if he stays next season, it's very unlikely that he's going to produce this again, because it's crazy enough he's doing it once. He's going to be a year older. He's already having a bit of a down patch at the moment. It's unlikely that he's going to produce, you know, the two greatest seasons in Premier League history at ages 32, 33. So there are lots of question marks around your rivals. Chelsea too. We don't know what Arsenal will end up doing. Manchester United in not a good situation. Villa slightly dodgy this season. Bournemouth, can they keep their manager? Can they keep their squad together? So if I want to win now, I probably go out there and look for a manager who's going to win now, who can provide something in the short term above the caliber of player that I've got. So maybe you go and give Jorge Schmidt a 1+1 deal, you know? I don't know if that's a good idea. but there are guys who are unemployed or who will be soon. Roberto Mancini is out there. Carlo Ancelotti might be out there. Now again, I don't know that. I'm not saying that Brighton are going to hire Ancelotti, though. I would love to see it. And even if they did, I don't know if those guys are right for them. They're probably not, in fact. But if Brighton's goal is to go for a Champions League now or go for a title in the next 3 years, which I don't think is all that crazy, then they obviously have to be examining everything they can do to maximize the chance of achieving that. And manager is actually a much more important thing to think about than getting another 18 to 23-year-old. So unless they go out and say, well, our centre-back, normally you'd expect us to go and get a £25 million centre-back from a lower league, but instead we're going to go and spend 60 or 70 mil on Antonio Silva. You know, we're going to get a world beater. We're going to go and sign Frankie de Jong. I don't know. If they think they can do that and they go and do that, then maybe that's a bigger deal than changing manager. But I think that manager has to be the biggest question mark for them going into the summer. And I'd be very intrigued to see who they settled on, but they've got to, they will know what their goals are and they've got to make sure that everything lines up, because they don't have a talent advantage on the rest of the league, as good as their talent is. And they don't have a financial advantage either. Things are going to have to line up perfectly for them to certainly win the title. Things are going to have to line up very, very well for them to get Champions League football the way they are for Nottingham Forest. They've got to find an edge anywhere they can. But I would love to see it. And it does feel like they're gearing up for a true run at something big. So that's interesting. And that can also change the perception of the club. You know, if you win something big, then it might be that little bit easier to convince some of these players to stay for 1 to 2 years longer. But I think that we all know that guys like Baleba and João Pedro are going to leave at some point. Brighton need to make the most of them while they're here. Okay, let's move on then. Lewis Rice. He's asking about Nottingham Forest. That's a perfect segue. He says, what are your thoughts on where Forest go from here? Obviously, where they actually finish is an open question, but do you think they need to transition to a more possession-based style, or do you think they would be better off as is? Well, that depends on what their goal is. If they make the top four, then their goal is probably to make the top four again and try and go really, really deep in the Champions League. I don't know that playing the style they play now is likely to get them top four again. But I can imagine that in Champions League football, this style would suit them pretty well. They're very physical. They're really well coached. They've got fast, clever, multi-threat wingers. And you can imagine Bayern, you know, you think about Bayern against Celtic, which was last night, or Real Madrid or whoever, having a really miserable time against them. A smart, deep block and counter setup is part of what has given success to someone like Unai Emery in European Cup football. So that could work for them. I suspect it wouldn't work quite as well in the league. Plus, of course, you go from competing in the league to competing in the league and the Champions League. It's really, really hard to do that. It's very hard to maintain results while you do that. You're almost always, especially if you are a less well-off club, you're going to see some drop-off in results in at least one of those competitions. Plus, it's kind of undeniable that they've been lucky this season. Things have gone their way. Now, don't get me wrong, they've also been good. They've definitely been good. But their expected goal difference, I think, is +3. And they've got and their goals conceded are exactly in line with their XG. They've conceded 29 from 29, basically. But they've scored 41 from 32, which is nice. Nice work if you can get it. And they've also had really favorable game state. So they've spent 40% of the time leading, which is fourth in the league. It's about the same as Arsenal. So I think only City and Liverpool are ahead of that. And they spent only 17.5% of the time trailing, which is less than anyone except Liverpool and Arsenal. So what does that mean? It means that they're often in a position to play the way they want to. They don't have to open up and try and score a goal because they're not coming from behind. They are very often in front, which means that they can pick off teams that are pushing up to try and score. They've scored 20 goals in first halves this season as well, and they've conceded 10. So they are going ahead very often. You can see that in there. And you look at a comparable team like Bournemouth. Bournemouth have scored 16 in first halves of games and they've conceded 30. So a +10 goal difference in the first half versus a +3. So Forest get into the game state they want, and it's easier for them to hold on or to add to that, to their score. A team like Brighton are better at ratcheting up the pressure as the game goes on. They're much more of a conventional, they play much more like a conventional big team, I guess, in that sense. Now, I'm not saying that getting into the lead, scoring early, all this stuff has nothing to do with quality, because clearly it does. And Chris Wood's having an amazing season, though Chris Wood is also a very old man. And like Mo Salah, it's unlikely to happen again. I'm not saying he's going to fall off completely, but the probability of having such a good season at his age, back-to-back, relatively low. But quite often as well, look, you can get the plan right and you can have the right personnel and everything can kind of theoretically be done correctly, create big chances early on, blah, 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 but they just don't go in, or the opponent scores out of nowhere. And then you're in trouble if you are a defending counter team. You know, a team like Liverpool can score their way out of trouble. More defensive sides have a difficulty here because you go behind, you've kind of got to abandon plan A, and by definition, you're probably not as good as at plan B. Forest have only taken 4 points from losing positions this season. Now, partially, that's a product of what I was talking about before. They haven't been behind very often, so it's hard to take points from losing positions. Though Arsenal and Liverpool have been behind less, and Arsenal have taken 11 points from losing positions, and Liverpool have taken 15, which is exactly what I'm talking about scoring your way out of trouble. But Fulham, who I think have been very good this year, Fulham have spent just 1% more game time trailing, so they've spent 18.7% of game time trailing to 17.5 for Forest. But Fulham have taken 12 points from losing positions because their attack is really quite good, much better than their defence. So if they get into a negative game state, it's not game over for them. If Forest get into a negative game state, it's a big slog out of there, barring something kind of magical. Then there's the bigger issue, right? Which is that if you have a miracle season playing this kind of football, it's usually manager, squad lining up. You know, you've built a squad and chosen a manager to enact this particular game plan. Or in this case, I think they chose the manager and the game plan that he wants to play, the game plan that he's actually really good at, made sense for the talent. It's very hard to then just open things up. The idea that, oh, we need to open up and play more expansively, it just doesn't really work that way. Managers find it very hard to do more than one thing. Most managers are good at one thing. And especially when you're a defensive side and a compact defensive side, it's quite hard to just open things up just enough that you get more attacking output, but not so much that the defense completely falls apart. Unless you've got elite defensive talent. And maybe they do, but I think they've just got very good defensive talent. You know, they're the lowest touch team in the Premier League this season. No team takes fewer touches than them per game. In order to consistently compete for the Champions League, you probably need to be at least an upper half side. That's a big gap. That's a big gap to bridge. It's much more common to see defensive teams, quote unquote, open up and then plummet down the table than to see them successfully develop a new style. So actually a version of this happened with Nuno, right? He finished seventh in that first Premier League campaign with Wolves. The next season finished seventh again. Though they brought back Jimenez, he got 17 Premier League goals. That's a big part of it. Do we think Wood's going to do that at his age? Question mark. If Forest go and get a really good centre forward who can be the Wood heir, then I'll become much more confident that they could do this. But teams are not going to let you play the way you want to play forever. We're in the back half of the season now, and it'll be really interesting to see how teams adapt to the way that Forest have played earlier in the season. Well, I did a podcast with Ravi Ramaneni on the the transfer flow, and he made this point that an interesting way to gauge managerial quality is to see how that manager does the second time round against teams, so in the second half of the season versus the first time when their tactics are more of a surprise. Well, we know what Nuno is, and I think Nuno's a pretty good tactician, but I don't think he's a genius. So I'll be quite surprised if he manages to consistently outcoach Premier League managers over the back half of the season. We will see. Or maybe they just get lucky and it doesn't matter. But in his third season with Wolves, they dropped to 13th and they went down to something like a minus 16 goal difference from plus 11. And Nuno left. So I would try and guard against that by adding more talent. Like I say, a Wood, somebody to spell Wood or replace him in the long term, some more central creativity, an amazing DM, because if you're going to open up, you really need an amazing DM. Right now, the defensive powerhouse in the side is not one guy, it's the structure. So if you're going to loosen the structure, then talent needs to fill that hole. So a really amazing DM would go a long way. But if you're going to prepare for a more open setup, it's not going to be a one summer thing. And you may have to face the fact that Nuno might not be the guy for it long term. Now, I think Forest can probably go and spend money. They could sell Murillo or someone for pretty big money and retool. They also always seem to produce cash despite FFP problems. But given that it's taken a lot of positive bounces this season, given that I think the league will adjust, given that they're going to have some version of European football next year and potentially Champions League football, I find it quite hard to be optimistic about this happening again. I think what you've got to... You know, Villa were arguably better set up for this than Forest. And Villa have had a bit of a difficult season. Like, not bad by any means. But in order to do well in the Champions League, they've had to give something up in the league. That's probably what it will look like for Forest. So always add talent. You definitely want to add talent. And there are positions I'd prioritize. But if I'm honest, I don't see it happening again. And I still think I've got a big question mark over whether they finish in the top five this season, just because the teams underneath them, at the very least, City and Bournemouth, I think are better than them, a bit more sustainable in their numbers. Chelsea, at some point, have got to work it out, I guess. So, yeah, those are my ideas. Let's do a quicker one. Okay, this doesn't look like a quick one, but I'm going to do it quickly. Turner says, how would you like the Premier League finance rules to be after the current ruling? So obviously we're talking about, you know, some of the stuff coming in with Man City right now. I kind of like the free-for-all it was back in the day where Chelsea could do whatever they wanted. Or we could have a salary transfer cap similar to America or some middle ground option. I think that clubs are going to have to... I think that a sensible thing would be to limit wages to revenue ratio. So right now, I think in 2023, the average Premier League club spent 66% of its revenue on wages, player wages. So most of these clubs lose money. In the Championship, it's even worse. In the Championship, I think it was like 110% at one point. So clubs are spending more than they spend on wages. Bearing in mind, they have lots of other expenses too. They're spending more on wages than they earn in a year, because the whole aim of the Championship is get to the promised land, get to the Premier League. Spending this proportion of your revenue on wages is pretty bad news for profitability. It's quite hard to be profitable at that level. But for football clubs, especially Premier League clubs, that hasn't really mattered for a long time. So Mike Goodman, Michael Cayley have talked about this recently, but it's been the case for a long time, which is that Premier League clubs can lose money, but appreciate as assets. So your club can lose £50 million every year, for example, but after 5 years, while you've lost £250 million, the club as an asset has gained 500 million in valuation. And the reason for that was TV rights. Because the TV rights deals kept going up and up and up and up, it meant that these clubs were seen as more and more valuable, even though the guys in charge of those clubs were not really making money. Some guys drain money out of it, like the Glazers. But it's actually quite hard to do that and stay competitive. And the Glazers had to not care that United stopped being competitive. There are very few teams in the Premier League that can accommodate a big money drain without getting relegated. Manchester United's one of them. So the problem with this is that TV rights seem to be leveling off, or maybe declining a little bit. And we should expect a bit of deflation in the football market over the next couple of years. And that's going to mean that teams have less money to spend on transfer fees, less money to spend on wages, at a time when the fixture congestion means that they need bigger squads. So that's going to have to mean that fees for players come down, wages for players come down. If they don't, you're just going to see teams use more academy kids or use the free market, the free agent market much, much more. So I think in order to prepare for this deflation, it's sensible to cap wages to revenue ratio. I also think that capping that just decreases the likelihood of disaster. And what we should really be trying to guard against generally is a club just going out of business. We don't want clubs to die because clubs provide jobs and are important community artifacts. Like they're really valuable to the places that they're in. And in order to protect them, we need to make sure that they don't get into a precarious financial situation they can't get out of. And if a team gets relegated when it's spending basically all its money, they get parachute payments, but those parachute payments run out. And it's very, very easy for teams to drop and drop and drop now. We don't want teams winking out of existence. So that's my broad idea. But to be honest with you, this is not my specialist area. So there are people like Swiss Ramble and Kaylee and Goodman who have more of a background in this. But that's my kind of back of an envelope idea for it. Okay, Callum T. Here we go. He's got two questions. We'll see if we get to the second one. But the first one, obviously a weird season with caveats for things like injury. But do you think there's any danger of a narrative forming that second best is Arteta's ceiling? Ooh. So, look, the Arsenal fan community is a strange place. Arsenal fans are entitled. And it's weird how they've become entitled again so quickly. I mean, I guess they were always entitled, but it's been really bad the last few years. Especially given that it's very recent memory that Arsenal were absolutely dog shit under Arteta, but really bad, completely unwatchable, in fact, under Emery most of the time. And even the last 5 years of Wenger were pretty miserable at times. Huge batterings at the hands of any good team. Passing in a U shape around bad teams quite often. Kind of looking like they were playing tactics from 10 years previously. Like when they pressed, they didn't do it in a coherent way. They didn't look like they had a plan to advance possession outside of individual quality. When it worked, it was the best thing to watch in the world. Wenger ball, in a lot of ways, is one of the best ways to break down a sitting defense. But as teams got smarter and more physical and that team got weaker, it just got really, really dire to watch. And now Arsenal are clearly one of the best sides in the world. I think Elo, who do ratings of these, I think they recently put them top of the world rankings, which is quite remarkable. And look, they never get out-muscled anymore. The defense is astonishing, astonishingly good. Arguably the best in the world. The atmosphere at the stadium is fantastic. And they've got loads of reasons to be positive because they're a young squad. They've got at least two world-class 23-year-olds in Saliba and Saka. And they've got some other outstanding players. They've got Gabriel, they've got Rice, they've got Urgod, and loads of good players. You know, you have no idea what Nwaneri and Lewis Skelly could turn into, but guys like Calafiori are obviously good. White is obviously good. Timber's obviously good. There are people like this all over the place. And it seems like Arsenal don't really struggle to attract talent anymore, which at one stage felt like it was happening. So there are lots of reasons to be positive. And if you think that the best Arteta can do is second place, I'd want to hear a good theory as to why the team can't get first. Because I don't think that... I think a lot of ex-pros kind of imply that there's this magical barrier between second and first place. And what's really important is that you learn the right magic spell to walk through it. And I just don't really think that that's true. Quite often we see the difference in these kinds of races made by luck. Unless you say that the magic spell is experience, but even then there are inexperienced teams who've managed to do it. So two seasons ago, Arsenal were not expected to be in the title race at all and exploded. And then it was clearly injuries and a miracle run from City that prevented them winning a title, right? That's what happened. Saliba got injured, a few other guys got injured. City were just on flames, and that's how it went. Last year, they managed to improve to 89 points, which was kind of astonishing. And this season, their metrics have been among the best in the world. Like I say, defensively, But they've had this insane injury crisis, and it really is insane. Their two best attackers out for months, like half the season each. Havertz and Jesus missing at least half the season each. I think every attacker bar Trossard has missed significant time, and I think he missed a little bit as well. And they're still second, and they've been dominant in the Champions League. They've lost one game in the Champions League, and that was on a bullshit penalty. Now, does this mean that Arteta can do nothing better? That it's just pure luck? No. I've talked about him being too conservative. Billy Carpenter, who's, I think, the best Arsenal writer out there, both in his insight and in the quality of his writing. He recently wrote a really excellent piece about Arsenal's 2023 summer window, and his argument was that it was a reaction to a big loss against Manchester City and that it was correcting some of the issues that were really obvious in that game. And his conclusion was that it was a big success, and I agree with him. And you never see this team get blown away now. It just never happens. They barely lose to big six teams. They haven't done it for a while. You so rarely see them outplayed, bar tiredness, red cards, injuries, you know, that sort of thing. You know, even in the Newcastle games in the cup, the second game they were outplayed. Though again, it's kind of the first game where I thought they probably should have won it. They could easily have drawn it. But you go into the second game and essentially you've started the game with a 2-0 deficit, right? And Newcastle can play in the game state they want and Arsenal can't. Now, I'm not saying they were good in that game. They were terrible. And I thought Newcastle were very good. But that's as bad as it gets for this Arsenal team, right? 2-0 loss away at Newcastle? So there are issues that you want to address. And part of it's personnel. You definitely need more pace up top. You definitely need more dribbling because Saka's the only really reliable dribbler in the squad. You need more shooting from the top of the box because that forces teams to adjust defensively. So you don't have to get that through transfers. You can get that through, you can ask Rice, Odegaard, Unweneri, you know, your guys who are clean, Saka, your guys who are clean ball strikers, you can ask them to take more shots from the top of the box and see what that does. You probably want to build a bit more centrally as well. Again, we've talked about them building out wide and how it's a bit of a defensive strategy, but also how it sometimes ends up with just cross after cross. You want a bit more flexibility, especially against the quote-unquote weaker teams. But the impressive thing about Arteta is that he's adjusted again and again. And I think the capacity to learn and change is what actually separates a truly great coach from a pretty good coach. Arsenal don't roll out the same tactics every season. They don't roll out the same tactics every game. The team has learned new things consistently. If you look... When Lewis Skelly came in at left back, even in his first game, which I think was in the Champions League, the first one I remember him starting, they played totally differently. Immediately, he was dribbling in the center of, like, he was in the middle of the pitch at the back, dribbling out of pressure. They don't do that with Calafiori. They certainly didn't do it with Kivior last year. So Arteta can try new stuff. He rolls out different shapes of press. He rolls out all sorts of different things at all times, and he's constantly iterating. And this season, okay, it sucks that Arsenal didn't win the league, though the Champions League is still on the table. But there's a lot of benefit from it, not just the young players who've come through, but also the team learning to play in different ways. So we have reason to believe Arteta can get better. Liverpool and City potentially have difficult spells coming up. You know, City are rebuilding. They need to continue rebuilding. Pep still might leave next summer. Liverpool are not going to have Van Dijk and Salah forever, and both those guys have been astonishingly good this season. So if your argument is that Arteta can only achieve second, I want to hear something that has more explanatory power than my claim that this season is a confluence of events. So Mo Salah being extraordinary, Arsenal having a bunch of injuries, blah, blah, blah. Your argument needs to be more convincing than that, I think. And usually it isn't. Usually it's just fans saying, like, Arteta's taken us as far as he can. And I think 89 points last year, probably 80 plus this year with the injuries. That, to me, is a pretty good baseline for success. In the end as well, when you say a narrative forming, that narrative might form in the fan base, but I don't think it's forming at the club. I don't think the club has any doubts about Arteta. They're going to keep him as long as they can. They seem sure he's the guy. And I do think as well, the rumours on the market seem encouraging. You know, Arsenal supposedly want Nico Williams, Zubimendi, and Benjamin Sheshko. And Arsenal need carrying capacity in the middle of the park and maybe some willingness to take on riskier passes. They need top level athleticism up front. You know, somebody who's really big, really strong, really fast, can also deal with, get on the end of crosses. They need more pace. They need creation off the dribble out wide. Well, those three players are pretty good remedies for those issues. And even Sverre Nipan, who they were linked with in January and who I think they'll go back for in the summer, would help with creation through the middle. So the identification of the problems is what you would want it to look like, or what I want it to look like as an Arsenal fan. You know, not to go after Wenger, because obviously, like, I love the guy. But quite often when he was in charge, Arsenal would go into the summer knowing what they needed. Or Arsenal fans would say, well, obviously we need DM, we need a centre-back, we need a striker. And they would come out the summer with nothing, with a keeper or with a utility midfielder or something. Like, it would never be just the lights out signing they needed. There are a bunch of seasons in there where if Arsenal had gone and spent, it was a lot of money at the time, but like 32 million on Higuain, or if they'd gone and just bought a defensive midfielder for 20 mil, 15 mil even at the time was a price you could get a DM for, they could have achieved a lot more. In some situations, they could have achieved titles. So I think at least the club doesn't seem to make those kinds of mistakes now, which is good. And that makes me broadly optimistic about the future. I think that there's good reason to be positive about this stuff. So yeah, that's my take on Arteta. I don't think he's going anywhere. Like, maybe Real Madrid strike out with Alonso in the summer and they go and try and get Arteta, and that's possible. Maybe then they would get him. So the club should be thinking about what happens if Arteta decides he wants to leave. But right now, I don't know. The narrative stuff. Arsenal fans are always fickle. They're going to complain about Arteta until he wins a title. If he never wins a title, it will be a disappointment. But I don't think it's because the process hasn't been good, at least not so far. There have been some missed tricks. They could have got someone in January. They could have got another forward last summer. But Arsenal are at the stage now where good might not be good enough. They need difference makers, game changers, guys who are going to come into the first 11. So it makes sense to me to keep the money there for the summer if you think that you can get these difference making players. And then you're looking at a team that can probably compete on all fronts and which is still very young. So yeah, that's Arsenal. I'll do another quick one and then I think we'll wrap here. So Callum T has another question, which is, do you think there are any reliable indicators for players who can successfully fill roles other than the ones they're expected in, e.g. Gravenberch, or is it more reliance on manager vision? Reliable indicators, I mean, probably what you see on the pitch. Like, if you see a guy who's playing left back but can dribble out of, or a centre back who can dribble out of pressure and who can hit passes through congested zones and cover a lot of ground, then like that's a pretty good indicator. Like, athletic attributes are going to transfer across positions. So if you said to me Arteta's going to start William Saliba at DM in a game this season, I'd say, yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, he's a good passer. He's very rangy. He reads the game well. He's good under pressure. I'm not saying he's going to be a superstar midfielder, but I think it'd be pretty good. So those sorts of things maybe are transferable. Yeah, that is a bit of manager vision. And probably as well, you've got to put people in a position to succeed. So the thing about Gravenberch, and I've praised him, but he's not a normal DM. You know, he's winning 3.8 tackles and interceptions per 90 minutes. It would be more if you adjust it for possession, but still, it's not that many. And so how is it looking so good? Well, McAllister is winning over 4 tackles and interceptions a game. Trent is at something like 4.2, which is a career high. And Virgil van Dijk is at 2.7, I think, and that is the highest he's been at in his entire time at Liverpool. So you've got all these guys around him doing more defensive work. That's part of it. Plus, of course, you've got a press that cuts off a bunch of stuff before it makes it as far as Gravenberch. So you've got to think about it as a role that needs to be performed. And if this guy can do these bits of it, can we fill these other bits in the aggregate? Quite often you can, not always, but quite often you can. Or can we build through another guy? Okay, we've got an amazing passing left back. Well, that means that our DM can be João Palhinha and can just crunch people. That's fine. You can do that instead. so then you could say, okay, he just does the defensive work and our left back does more of the build up. And we've seen that in teams like Liverpool, who used Trent to do it. So are there reliable indicators like the eye test, I guess, and smart tacticians who know what else they can get out of a squad? But I often think when a player changes position, you've got to look at what they're not doing as well as what they are doing. Gravenberch has always been a really good passer. And the thing is, in the Netherlands, he was this weird tweener 8-10. Kind of like the player that Pogba turned into later on, which was he's not quite a 10. He gives you creativity from a slightly deeper position on the field and not particularly defensively active. So in Gravenberch's case, you kind of say, well, he can't be our 10 because he's not quite as creative as a top level 10. And if he's going to be our, and he could do the passing for an 8, but he needs defensive support. So I think the passing was always there. You know, the passing, they were like, well, he could definitely do the passing. All he needs to do is up his defense enough. And he's pretty rangy. And how smart is he? Is he smart enough that we can teach him where he needs to be? Is he smart enough that we think he can position himself to win loose balls? Is he athletic enough that he can keep pace with guys breaking through the middle? If he could do all that stuff, then he's probably going to be okay. But I think it's been a success as a unit this season at Liverpool. And normally it's a success as a unit when a guy plays position. Or sometimes they're just playing a simpler position in some ways, you know, or a position that actually maybe would have made sense for them. You look at someone like Ben White. Well, Ben White can do some DM stuff, can do some right back stuff, can do some center back stuff, but he likes to roam and he likes to hit risky passes and he's surprisingly quick and he's a good technical player. He's good at ghosting into the back post. All this stuff makes him a better fit at right back than center back. So he changed position, but did he really, you know? Okay, I think that brings us to the end for the free episode. I will continue with some questions over on the paid side. I'm not going to do the burn book today because I think it would just be a little bit boring without Pete here to bounce off. I don't know when he'll be back. He might not be back for the next one, so I might try and get a guest for that one. But let me know how you felt about this, whether this seemed like, whether you enjoyed it and this felt like something you would like to hear me do again. It might be nice every time we're building up a bunch of questions that we don't quite have time for on the show, if I can just rip through a few of them. Thank you very much for your support. We really do appreciate your subscriptions, and especially right now when life is becoming more expensive for our beloved Pete Dorman. I will catch you over on the paid side or in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you very much. Bye.